So instead of going actually to the four-dimensional case, to the Barre-Cray model, I would prefer to introduce you to the goofy theory formulas instead. So that, well, you get in touch with a rather different type of formulas, and not just with a four-dimensional version of the previous one. So before doing that, I want to give you just two more little details about the geometry of the Ponsatore-Ray model. Not going to be too much. And then in order to prepare the ground for the group theory, I have to recall some basic Feynman diagrams, basic stuff on Feynman diagrams. I hope that you know already a little bit of Feynman diagrams so that the brief review is going to be enough. Okay, Ponsatore-Ray model. First, I recall you where we got to in the last lecture. So we started from a discrete version of DF theory on a given triangulation. And this was something like that in its group notation. So you remember we started with this discretization of the BFT reaction. So we set up the path integral, and at the end of all chain of calculations and manipulations and rearrangements, we arrived to this formula. It was a sum over all the representations of the SU2 group assigned to each triangle of the triangulation, to each edge of the triangulation. And we have a product over all the edges of the triangulation called edges of the for each edge of the triangulation. Here we have 2j plus 1 as an amplitude for each edge. And then there was a product over all the tetrahedra of the triangulation of a specific function of 6 of these variables, one for each edge of the tetrahedron. And this is the 6j symbol. So for what matters here, it's just a scalar function of the 6j's referring to it. Okay? So this was a tetrahedron amplitude, and this was for each link of the triangulation. We had written it in terms of the dual, so that instead of the edges, we consider dual faces. And instead of tetrahedra, we consider dual vertices. It's the same expression. Okay? Do you remember this?
What is the dual vertex?
Well, we've chosen for the triangulation a dual complex that had a vertex for each tetrahedron or the original triangulation. So it's a vertex. You consider
it.
Choose a vertex for each tetrahedron.
Yes.
And then there will be an edge dual link for each triangle of the triangulation. Another one here.
Right.
Then there were the faces.
Yes.
So the when you start gluing all the tetrahedra, you also start gluing all these dual building blocks, and you form a complex. It is not necessarily a visual complex. And it's made out of vertices, links, and faces.
So every dual vertex is at the center of the original attribution.
Well, here the specific embedding is not important, just a topological correspondence.
Right.
So for each tetrahedron, you have a vertex.
Okay.
You don't have to choose a specific embedding. Okay. Okay, so this was the structure of the Ponzano reticle. I've hinted to the fact that the representation of SK2 here, so the spins, and interpretation of edge length. Okay. And now I want to say something more about the old geometric picture coming out of this Ponzano reticle moment. So the first thing I want to tell you, so I'll just state the result so that you see that we're talking about gravity, so geometry of a three-dimensional manifold. Well, it's the classic result first shown, although a little bit heuristically, by Ponzano reticle. And that was like 68, when before the idea of the spin foam models was formalized. So this object, if you take the J to be very large, and this has the interpretation, suppose that you consider the, well, like J plus 1 times the Planck length to give you the length of the edge. So the idea is to go to a kind of a semi-classical limit in which, for a given length, you send LP to 0 and you send J to infinity, so that the product remains finite, but you neglect the fact that it's actually quantized. Right? So in this limit, so for J, all the J's going to infinity, what has been proven is that, okay, this object has a prefactor in front, which is also a function of the J's, but then it gives you the cosine of the Rege action for the triangulation, so for the magnitude you started with, as a function of the J's, playing exactly the role of the edge length. Okay? So you have a contact with a classical gravity theory. Of course, you expect the first contact with gravity to be made at this intuition level before you try to study some continuum limit or continuum approximation. Okay? So that was one result that prompted some interest in the Ponzano reticle model. Now I want to say something more about how you describe the geometry of three-dimensional space.
Just interrupting the question about the limit of large J, mm-hmm. and then taking a look at the opposite limit of small J. Mm-hmm. How can J go to 0?
In principle, yes, it's an allowed representation.
So what would the edge length be in such a case?
Surprise?
No, just in the sense that if I treat this like a lattice, then L sub P would be the measure of the lattice, mm-hmm. and then J would just be kind of like the excitation level. So the simplest building blocks correspond to the smallest J value.
In fact, the idea of studying the continuum limit in terms of this asymptotic behavior is not the only one that is considered viable. I mean, another one is to say, well, the continuum is actually approximated not for large J's, but for many, many tetrahedra and right. very, very small j's,
right.
Without taking any approximation on L Planck.
What about zero j?
So that depends very much on the exact spectrum you consider. So also this is under a bit of debate. To be fair, I mean, now I'll show you how this picture comes about in terms of the geometry of a three-dimensional manifold described in terms of these fields, these variables. But the edge length spectrum that appears here in the asymptotics is actually of this type. P to J plus 1. And that is quite different from that. It is quite different in terms of the values that it takes for 0 and so the details of the spectrum. But at the end of the day, is basically just so what you actually obtain is the square of this. At first, as an operator, as a chasm. And the chasm is defined up to a constant. Now, if you just take j plus 1 plus.
That one looks like spin j times j plus 1, and that one looks like the ground state energy that I'm on across
over. I'm sorry, I said something wrong. This is the square of that you can see. Well, it doesn't change much of the discussion, but it changes the relation between the two. Because you just add the constant, take the square root, and this is just 2j plus 1. up to a factor. Now you're doing the calculation, do it later. It's straightforward. Okay, so and so these details of the geometric picture will change according to the Ekman spectrum you can see. I don't want to discuss this too much here. I want to just show you in which sense you can consider this picture of the quantum geometry as arising directly from the choice of variables there. So here we have something that is valued in this Riemann 3, because it's in the algebra of SE2. Okay. So consider a link in R3. So that is basically, well, it associated variable of this type. And the geometry of that link is just the length. And classically, if you have a link in R3, the length would just be given by, length would be the square root of the scalar product within sub. Right? So, assuming the correspondence of the ET with the generic, with the basis of the algebra, so this is basically a polynomial. It would be a polynomial in the representation one half in general, just an algebra element. Well, this object, well, is given by that. Okay. So what is the first way you would quantize such a classical picture? Here is just a classical object, okay? Which is a Lie algebra element, so it's an element of R3 numbers. The first quantization you do, you would be, if you're smart, to go to a representation of that Lie algebra element. Because quantizing basically means associating some Hilbert space to the object and a set of operators. So here the operators will just be SC2 operators or the algebra operators in SC2. And the Hilbert space is that the association of a Hilbert space to the geometric object is done by basically going from ET to the Lie algebra element in a given representation. So that this comes with the choice of a Hilbert space for the given representation. For example, if you choose the representation 1, there is a Hilbert space which is three-dimensional, and the three possible values of the angular momentum projection. Okay? So there is a vector space associated to a choice of representation. Are you lost or you're just digesting after lunch? You fine with this? Okay. And if you choose, if you write this operator, now it's an operator, in a specific representation. Maybe I shouldn't call it that anyway. So this is just the Casimir, in the Casimir of SC2 in the chosen representation. Okay? So as the quadratic invariant is the square root of the Casimir. So the quadratic invariant you construct out of the algebra element. So basically, J square. Okay? You've seen J square already. And, even if I use too many J's, let's call the representations with spin. And this object is the square root of J plus 1. You know this already from your courses. So you see that it's this simple step and quantization procedure that directly associates a spectrum, the length of the edge which associated the variable E. Okay?
Is this the one step where you have the product of the two triads and then you create that two?
Yeah, you can make slightly different choices.
Right. So just that one equality where you have the square root of the tetrad triad equal to the square root of the two angular momentum operators.
Mm-hmm.
What's the basis of that equality?
Well, let's say simply the simplest choice. In general, you would expect E to be a linear combination of the algebra element, basis of the algebra. elements of the phase of the invariant. But that would complicate the formula. But the invariant quantity that you would associate to that edge will still be there. It just the formula would involve, and you wouldn't get directly that result. But I mean, it's still, the question here that gives an answer to is simply, what is the invariant quantity that after quantization I can associate to the edge? And that's the cousin of the representation. Once I decided that the way to quantize is to associate the representation to the edge. Okay, that's just an edge. Now, suppose that we want to do more, because we want to describe a Hilbert space for the full two-dimensional geometry. Okay, because we know we are in three dimensions, so space-time is three-dimensional, but we expect Hilbert space of states, if a canonical decomposition is allowed, to be associated to two-dimensional simplicial spaces, simplicial manifolds, right? And simplicial manifolds in two dimensions made out of gluing triangles. So we want to understand, now that we quantize an edge, how to quantize a triangle. Well, it's simple. For each triangle, we have now it just moves the same shots around. It doesn't
actually,
really
it's like we usually don't have such nice clean boards.
Look, so I should consider myself lucky. Okay, so you have a triangle, and you have these variables, or if you want directly this elements there, associated to each of them. This was E from the very start.
I don't understand something, because the edges you're talking about here correspond to points in the two-dimensional picture, if you
didn't
slice. So you have a
measure. No. I'm now really just talking about, I take the two-dimensional simplicial complex, and there are edges. So it's a collection of triangles. And these is associated both to time-like edges, if you want, so edges that just puncture the boundary, but also to edges in the boundary. So that is just my discretization of the action, wherever the edges are. Okay. So there is an edge here, then another one here, another one. So let me simplify the notation, 2 and 3. And they're all vectors. Right? So first you would just say that first you would just say that if the Hilbert space for a single edge is given by h of j1, in order to associate the Hilbert space to the old triangle, I will just take the tensor product of this Hilbert space. And so that the wave function, so the state that I associate to my triangle, will be an element of this tensor product. This is true, but it's not the whole story, because it's not that if I give you three random vectors, they're constrained to form a triangle. I mean, they can be anything. Then you have to impose that the three edges are such that they close to form a triangle. I'm talking about this three-dimensional flat space, R3. Okay. The constraint classically is simply that E1 plus E2 plus E3 equals 0 as vectors. This translates, again, I don't want to show you the detail I can later, but first of all, I'll say more about like plan 2. This translates at the quantum level as invariance, let's call it this, invariance under ST2. So basically it means that the thing closes.
So the vector is referring to the ST2 index I. And so when you draw the triangle, you can draw a triangle with three vectors, which are if the triangle closes in space. So you can draw triangular three spatial vectors. So you have to have two sets of indices, spatial and S.
You should do a decomposition, but here you just take a triangle in R3. And you just want the three vectors to close. That's the real requirement. I haven't done any canonical decomposition into space plus
so time. Then your vector symbols refer to the spatial aspect of
No. The vector refers to this. I just want the thing to close in three space, three dimensional space.
So they're triangles, not spatially triangles. They're
principally
triangles. Sure.
Yes. But, well, this is the same as actually the Lyapunov.
Right, so that was my confusion then. We have two sets of indices. We have the S with two set of indices, which also is R3, and the
spatial indices. No. Here we are already in discretized level. We have integrated out over spacetime. So it's just that to each edge we have an Lyapunov SU2 element.
Right.
There are no other indices.
So there's no other triangles in SU2 or R3.
Yeah.
Certainly,
yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And, okay. So this means that we indeed have a tensor representing our state, so representing our triangle. But it's not a generic tensor in this space, but it's an invariant tensor. So it's the condition of being invariant under the simultaneous action of SU2 over all three arguments. Okay. Well, and the example for this is exactly the 3J symbol I mentioned last time. And that is indeed used to construct the Gonzalo-Reggio model. In general, you expect a linear combination with this index bearing of 3J symbols to give you a state. Okay. And then we know the result already, but even if you didn't know the result of discretizing BF in these variables, from this geometric reasoning, you could expect that the way to associate a number to a tetrahedron, given that the tetrahedron is made out of four triangles that you quantize in terms of this object, would just be to contract them pairwise to give you a number, so to eliminate all the dependence on this projection indices. That will give a number function of only the representations. And indeed, that number is the J symbol we derived last time.
You constructed the length operator, right? Mm-hmm. The number of triangle. Do you need to construct the area operator?
Don't need to, but I could. I don't need to because I already identified the state in terms of only this constraint and length. But in principle, I could. It just means that I have all the variables to construct the geometry of my three-dimensional manifold. Well, I don't go into the review of how you can associate, how you can describe the geometry of the tetrahedron, so a three-dimensional geometry in this case, out of six numbers, so the six edge lengths. But it's clear, just out of counting, that you can do it up to rotations and translations. So up to the location in three space, that's enough to characterize fully the geometry. So I have all the information there. Okay, so this was just to reassure you that although this expression doesn't look very geometric, it's just a spin formula, so the variables are spins, so representations of a group, and just amplitudes for them. We are actually describing geometry, and these variables have a geometric interpretation. And you can get to there in many ways. Analyzing the asymptotic is one. You already see that you are actually describing geometry in terms of edge lengths that are given by your spins. And there is this kind of other conversation procedure that leads you there. OK, so I would like to go now to the group field theory, hopefully. And first, I just want to revise very, very briefly the idea of Feynman diagrams. So So just the idea, because to show you how Feynman diagrams actually arise and how you construct Feynman outputs will take not the whole course, but at least one or two lectures. So first take the problem. So suppose that you have a scalar field theory. So you have a function as an integral over a scalar field, functional integral, and the partition function is defined t for x. Suppose we are in four dimensions, okay, so that the field theory should be more used. And you have, so the action is 1/2. That means skip a step here. Five. Then there is an interaction. Let's take it to be a 5^4 interaction. And let's assume that there is also a source. Okay, so that's the partition function for a scalar field theory in four dimensions, flat space. So quantum field theory reduces basically to computing this object, because that's the object that defines the theory. Well, computing this object is hard, and so what you can do is to try to compute it perturbatively. Since the difficulties in computing the object do not arise from the kinetic term, which is just quadratic, and you know how to do Gaussian integrals, and it doesn't arise from this term, which you can think of it as just a part of the quadratic term, but it arises from this, so from the interaction. So the problem is the interacting field theory, not the free field theory. So instead of dealing with all the technicalities here, I just give you a special simplified example, which has the same qualitative features. So you want to integrate in one dimension, because q is a variable in R, so on the real line, going from minus infinity to infinity. And the integral you want to perform is the analog of that. Plus to minus doesn't change anything. Okay, so you realize it's a simpler version of this. But the problem is again, if it was just a free theory, so just with the quadratic term plus the source, which can be absorbed in the quadratic term, you would just do again a Gaussian integral. So you would just write the result. But you have this nonlinear term. So what you can do here is to say, well, I can do a perturbative expansion, basically a Taylor series expansion, in lambda. Okay? So this basically gives minus square plus q. And then here at 1 minus lambda 4 plus lambda 4/2 q to the a plus blah blah. Okay? Just this function. You alive? You fine with this? You better be. So I mean 1/2, you mean here?
The last term concept.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry. Come on. If we keep track of all the numerical factors already in the simple example, we just get lost in the legal details. So just follow the what the idea would be in computing the thing, the integral. Okay, so let's write it a bit more formally. So this is just assuming, this is actually a key point, unfortunately, that we can swap integration and summation, which is the origin of many problems in field theory. This is just the sum over the, well, let's say the power of the interaction term, or if you want, the power of the coupling constant, of, well, minus 4 to the n. And then there is an amplitude that is a function of j and depends on the order in which you are computing it. The amplitude is basically the result of doing integral order by order. Okay? So integrating this object with just this or with just this. Okay. Oh, and just a note, both in this case and in this case, the partition function for the theory without source is just obtained from here putting j to 0, of course. Okay? And you can do it also order by order. So, what's the best way to do this? Okay, so the problem basically is evaluating integrals of this type. And something like q to the 4th. Okay. But we know that this can be written as the derivative over j of just the free integral. Okay. I have always this problem of writing too large. Too much in the right. And it doesn't help. So, this object can be calculated, which is the free integral. And it is just, let's see if I get it right, and then I check. Just out of curiosity. So it's j square, blah, 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 1 over m square, and I get the derivative 2. Let's check. Fine. And okay, there is a factor in front that also comes from, is a function of m. Anyway, so basically, this summation over powers of lambda is reflected also in the powers of these derivatives here. So the whole thing can be written. Like q to the minus 4 q to the 4th, and then you have the free integration 1 over 2 square and square. Okay? And there is a factor in front. You with me? Okay, so suppose that we just want to understand what is the structure of the various orders. So we again we want to compute all these amplitudes. Okay, so that we define the partition function through this series. the term that it's used. Well, I give you one example. So if I go to first order in lambda and fourth order 4 in J, the evaluation, I'm not of the old thing, so the old first order is so it's given by lambda j4. Okay, so the factor, the actual result of the integration is this part, including all the factors in front. Now, the interesting thing is not so much the evaluation, but if I had given you a simple example, this object with all the combinatorial facts in front, like the numbers, like factorials and stuff, can be obtained through diagrammatic techniques. Meaning, you're interested in the fourth order in J and first order in lambda. So what you do is to say, well, how many graphs can I construct associating a line to each J, an external line to each J, and a vertex that is four valent. So these are the ingredients, J here. And the other crucial point would be this one. Given that I have just one vertex and four external lines. So one possibility is, so I have external lines like this, four, and there should be one order of interaction. So well, this may just go like this. This may actually reach the point of interaction, and then it should be four valent. So I can draw this. You would need here. But this is not the only diagram I can consider. So I can consider, well, the trivial one, the most obvious one is the simplest four valent figures. Okay. And here there's another funny one. Let's take this. This, these are the external lines, and then that. This is disconnected, but satisfies that property. So it's one order in a four-valent interaction and four external lines. Well, four external points, meaning the sources, the J's. Okay. So the numerical factors in front come from just writing down all the possible diagrams given these conditions. First order lambda and fourth order in J. And so you can write down simple Feynman rules for this simple example, which is basically for each vertex, you have to say just lambda. For each external line, external point, sorry, you have to say source. Term. And for each line of propagation from one point to either to the vertex or the other boundary point, you have to say 1 over n squared. So here you will have this 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. The same here, 4 lines, 1, 2, 3, 4. So you have this to the fourth. So the amplitude is given by just writing down these rules, looking at one diagram. Then the number of diagrams with appropriate similes and so on will give you also the numerical factor in front.
So what happened to the momentum?
Sorry?
What happened to the momentum in the proper year?
Well, you can write down final rules for the same theory by just doing Fourier transform of the Quinton. The same type of structure.
I was just wondering why the 1 over n squared isn't 1 over n squared plus p squared.
We get p squared. No. I think you just get n squared. Because the thing you would Fourier transform is this constant. And this doesn't depend on q.
You don't have derivatives in the
Right. Another way to say it is that in the every term here, you don't have any derivatives.
Oh, right.
Which plays the role of T. So the propagator is really just 1 over n squared.
Right.
Both, yes. I'm simplifying the old thing, of course. Okay, but this is the idea of final diagrams. You want to evaluate that integral, which is solving the field theory. You do it perturbatively in lambda. And there is a diagrammatic way of writing down the correct answer for the object you associate to the for the number you associate to each diagram. So a better way of writing this would actually be sum over n of minus lambda for factorial n, and then there will be a sum over all Feynman diagrams that have the same order. And here there is an amplitude for each Feynman diagram of that order. Because we have just seen that to each order, there are actually many diagrams you can associate. So you can just as well sum over all the diagrams separately. Except that then most of them will have the same, many of them will have the same amplitude in this example. Okay, so so let's just write down what changes briefly in the true case here. So the d squared plus n squared is the analog of the n squared here. And there is a dependence on x because the field depends on x. Well, one can show that the analog of this object is identified directly from the kinetic part of the action, just for the free theory, from the free theory. Free theory is this. This object, let's see if I manage to write it again. So the result is simply right here. So you see that we get quadratic term in J, and here in the middle we have the analog of 1 over m squared. So the easiest expression for this object y is in momentum space, so e for p of e I p y, this is four dimensional integral minus m squared plus f. And there is the, okay, you have to analytically continue the whole thing, but I mean this is just technicalities. Okay. And the important point here, well, there are two important points. One is that you can check that this object, this function, is indeed the inverse of this kinetic term there, which is exactly what this object is, although in a much simpler case. is just 1 over m squared. This is the inverse of the kinetic term we have here, which was m squared. The same is here. The second point is to recall what I said in the first lecture, which is the fact that this function can be given a sum over histories formulation. So this is just the transition amplitude for a single relativistic particle going from the initial point y to the final point x. I've written it here in momentum space, but I can actually write it as sum over all possible paths in going from one from y to x. Okay. So even in this field theory context, we have in the single particle cycle just a sum over histories for a single particle. The Feynman diagrams for the full theory will be, again, we have a four-valent interaction. So they basically have exactly the same structure as these ones. I just write all the possibilities, except that I associate lambda, as in the simple case, to each order of interaction, so to each vertex of interaction, J4 to each vertex, to each external line. But then J is a function of x. The propagator is going to be a function of the initial and final point for each line to which I associate it. And there will be integrals over x. The vertex term can be seen easily this way. So what I had was phi to the 4, phi as a function of x. But this is equal to phi of x, phi of y, phi of z, phi of
w,
and then there are deltas, x minus y's, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so basically this says the kinetic term will be a bunch of delta functions. These are the interaction term that I would plug here instead of just lambda. I would have lambda times a function of x given by a bunch of delta functions that basically force all the fields to act, to interact locally in a point. You see this? So this would be is the analog in true field theory of just having lambda in the simple example. Just as using this function of x and y is the analog of having just 1 over m squared in the simple example. So at the end, the bottom line is the following. I want to evaluate the path integral from my field theory. The way I usually do it is to expand the Feynman diagram, so all possible interactions that can occur for given source, so at different orders. I draw all the possible diagrams, and in order to construct this amplitude, I have just to insert this interaction operator for each interaction vertex. I have to insert this propagator for each line. And then I have to do the integrals over x, basically gluing together this part with this line, this part with this, and so on. Okay. You see what the idea is? I mean, I haven't shown you all the details in the construction of this object for a field theory, but it is really just taking care of the functional dependence of the phi and or the vertex operator and so on, but it's not. The idea is exactly the same. And you have to do this. So are you ready to graduate to group field theory? But if that was the only concern, it would be quite happy. Okay. Okay, so if I given you already one reference for the group field theory, it was the last reference I wrote down on the blackboard last time, but I give you another one. It's also good. So one was mine, just because it is more introductory. And it was to see to one, three. Ilyas, I'm a much better expert than I am. Slide around. And it's H 05 05 06. Okay. Oh, by the way, I don't think we're going to have any break. Okay. But the wine will be there for at least 10 more minutes. So, what is group field theory in just one sentence? It's a field theory, and then okay, up to here you follow me. And then I could just say on the group manifold, but that would be okay, even ridiculous as the start of the sentence. But it's a field theory whose one particle states are supposedly n minus one simplices. So in the same way as the field theory as written here as one particle states scalar relativistic particles, so that the propagator is just the propagator for a relativistic particle. The idea here is to construct an interacting theory of n minus one simplices, so in n dimensions, meaning in the three-dimensional example we were in, of triangles. So we just have triangles interacting, and this interaction process creates space-time. And the way it's going to do it is as a Feynman diagram. So consider, again, the simple example. What you actually measure is the thing here and the thing here. Okay? So, and these are going to define your states of your field theory. Initial and final states. In the gravity case, we expect this to be n minus one dimensional geometries. So we just see space, okay, or at least an n minus one dimensional manifold. We don't see space-time, so the n dimensional manifold. But here also, we don't see trajectories. What we measure is only initial and final states. The trajectories, which is the space-time history of a particle or of a collection of particles, emerges in this field theory picture as a Feynman diagram. So there's going to be one possible interaction process, so one possible history of my collection of particles for each Feynman diagram. The same is going to be realized in group field theory, but the same is realized in group field theory, maybe the wrong way, but it does. So, let me point out another difference, just another nice fact. So you may say that, well, what we're doing is something like this for gravity. We have a three-dimensional or two or whatever dimensional geometry for space, another one here, and we're considering these as a possible Feynman diagram. Space-time is just this simple topology, and there is a given space-time geometry in the middle. Another possible Feynman diagram is something like this, with the same boundaries. looks just like the same, right? It's not. There is a hole. So it basically is like, this is just an analogy here. There is a particle that splits into two particles, and they join again in one. So it's a process of this type. If it was just field theory, trivalent interaction. Okay. In fact, this idea, the idea of a field theory formulation for geometry, was first put forward in this context. So we have a universe that either just evolves to another universe or splits into one or more universes, into two or more universes. They interact again. And I have a field theory that describes all the possible interactions as Feynman diagrams for a universe. This is the idea of third quantization. That name is a bit awkward, but that was the first name proposed. Now, I can tell you about this more formal setting later. And this is as formal and even worse. And as
third quantization, in the sense that in second quantization, you have a box space. So
no, in this case, the name, this is the reason why it's a bit awkward, this name. The Fock space arises only in the third quantized step.
Yeah, Fock space? Like Prince particle?
Yeah. Being the universe, yes, yes.
Right.
Now, the point is that it's a third and not a second quantization, because the first quantized theory is already field theory. That was why we coined the name third quantization. But it's just a field theory, so truly the second quantization of something. So it's the idea of promoting the wave function of the universe, as it was a Schrödinger wave function, to an operator, and build up a field theory from this operator. That was the original idea. Now, I don't want to discuss all this in detail, because first of all, it's mathematically very formal. If already, well, you can imagine that if already this object was extremely formal and difficult to make sense of, just imagine the interaction of universes in the continuum.
Is it testable,
the interaction of universes? It's not definable, rigorously. So I mean, if it was a consistent theory and the problem would just test it, I mean, it would be all working.
Well, no, a serious question would be, in the case where you have an internal loop, so you're taking your propagator and you're using this expression where obviously it's off shell in the sense that special relativity p squared minus m squared is zero. So this only makes sense in the sense that you're integrating over all momentum, and so it's off shell. So what is the analog in this, I guess, virtual universe instead of a virtual particle? How can we take it off shell?
Well, you just don't impose the Hamiltonian constraint. P squared minus m squared for a particle is the Hamiltonian constraint. For gravity, you would just work with an object here. If it has to define a propagator for this topology, if it is a true propagator, then this is a function. This is a function of h1, h2. Well, instead of having this equal zero, that would be like a scalar product for the two states. This would be the delta function, appropriately defined. And again, formally you can do all this. But the reason I don't want to discuss all this, and I didn't want to discuss all this in more detail, is first of all the fact that it's mathematically just formal. It's very hard to make sense of any calculation here. But another one, that this is physically doubtful. The reason is that it is a very global picture. You are really thinking about the whole universe, however it is measured. But I have no idea how I would measure properties of my own universe, that then interacts and creates more universes. They're even more difficult to make sense of physically. Okay. So the main advantage, from my point of view at least, of the group field theory is that it realizes this idea, but locally. Because the objects that it creates and annihilates and makes interact are just chunks of space. So not the full three-dimensional simplicial geometry, but just the, if we're in 4D, but just the tetrahedra, or in 3D, just the triangles. And so let me just go to the proof here. Is this relevant? We have 1 hour, right?
Well, we can take the dress from which is the one.
Just the glasses. We don't care about the dress. Okay, so I've just told you what the geometric picture behind the Ponzano-Reggio model was. So you were quantizing a triangle made out of gluing edges. That was our two-dimensional state. Okay. So in general, you would have wave function that depends on the three spins. Okay, because these were the three variables that characterize the geometry of a triangle under the condition that psi is invariant under the action of the group, the action of S2. Okay. Make a manifest signs of understanding by moving the head or shouting or anything. Yeah, please, otherwise I just don't know where I'm going, too fast, too slow, where you're completely lost, where everything is completely obvious to you, or okay, give me some feedback. Okay, so it's a function of three representations. You remember we had this function of a representation, it was the character in the expansion of the delta in defining the Ponzano-Reggio model. And I told you that that was just a very special case of the general harmonic analysis that you can do on functions on the group. And the general form would be that you have a function on the group and you can sum from the representations with some, you obtain some Fourier modes with indices k, and here instead of the character you will get a representation matrix. Okay. The formula I've given you before in the last lecture, it was just for the particular case of a delta function. So in general, if you have just a function of position in one dimension, you would have integral over dp of a function of p, and then you would have a Fourier coefficient. That. Okay. And for the specific case of a delta, here you just have one. So the Fourier coefficient of a delta is just the number one. Yeah.
Here is a concrete example which is a bit more complete than this one.
More complete?
Less simple.
Well, you can go to R3. The three-dimensional example, I mean, this is a group, and it can be, it's SC2, for example, in our example. The three-dimensional manifold, I'm considering function on that manifold. And then this function in representation is really just like Fourier transform on that space. In principle, you can derive the expansion very geometric, like taking a function of on R3, but subject to the constraint that it is actually on the two sphere. I'm sorry, a function R4, and it is actually on the three spheres, because the three sphere is the same as SU2. Do the Fourier analysis in R4, impose the constraint again, and you will get the harmonic decomposition of the function SU2.
Okay, so for the sphere, it's just decomposition to a...
In harmonics, spherical harmonics. Oh, I didn't know you knew about spherical harmonics. But in the case of SU2, the harmonic analysis is indeed harmonic, because it's decomposing harmonics. So you're decomposing spherical harmonics. Okay. But I didn't want to say too many examples, because this is really very general. You can do it for the Lorentz group in some cases and some care. You can do it for SO4. It's really just harmonizing the group. And it is the analog of Fourier transform. That's my only point here. I didn't hear what you said, but okay. So here we are in the opposite case, meaning we have a function on the of the representation, not on group variables. But well, sorry, let me just call this phi. But it's exactly the same. I can Fourier transform back. And to this would correspond, I don't write the full formula, a function of three group elements with this arising as Fourier coefficients in the harmonic decomposition of this. Because I can do harmonic analysis on each of the group elements separately. And for each of them, I will get one representation, so a spin. So I can equally write my function, my wave function, as a function of three group elements or as a function of three spins. This was an invariant function, and the corresponding constraint here is that this is equal to G. It's invariant under the simultaneous action of SC2 on the three arguments.
So is that the Gauche field?
Sorry?
The Gauche field?
Gauche field. Why? It's a scalar field theory that I'm talking about. It's obviously a scalar field, meaning just a map. So in this case, it's just a map from three copies of the group to, well, for simplicity, to the real numbers. Scalar in this case, in this sense, not because it transforms in any way under the Lorentz group. Okay, so it is a function of three group elements, and for each choice of group element, it gives me a real number. Because of this property, this is actually a function from this quotient.
Okay. The true theory is simpler in the sense that the fields are still defined on the space time now.
Well, there are many senses in which it's not really is not a gauge field theory. I mean, the in gauge field theory is the field is usually a vector field, and I mean there are many things that marks a difference. So it's a gauge theory only in the sense that there is a gauge symmetry, if you want. But this really.
But even when you quantify the gauge field theory, is there a function that's a group element attached?
Yeah, but that is where the analogy starts. Okay, so you should. The reason why I'm doing this is to make the link with what I said previously. We had a triangle that was our basic building block for a two-dimensional simplicial manifold, because our space manifold for the three-dimensional Poisson-Rogge model. To that, we associated a wave function. In the same way as in canonical quantum gravity, if you want, we associate a wave function to the whole universe that is a function of the free geometry. And then the idea here is to promote this wave function that represents only state in my Hilbert space for a triangle to an operator that can be written either in a representation space or in a configuration space, being just as a function of group elements. Now, the peculiarity here is that, as I said, we are local, meaning we are quantizing building blocks of my two-dimensional, in this case, manifold, not the old manifold together. So if we don't fix the topology of the old manifold, or the space manifold, and we allow, for example, for having a boundary, because I can consider like a triangle, glued here, but with these four edges not glued to anything. so just on the boundary. So this is just a local chunk of a surface. So in principle, it can be, well, here we are in four dimensions, but I can just say I take this chunk of space with a boundary, and the boundary is what I see, is the measurement. And I let it evolve, and I compute the process, an evolution process with my theory, and compute the amplitude for a specific type of process, like I compute the amplitude for a specific final graph. Okay, this is all a bit of blah blah, but that means that I have two types of states that I can consider. One is corresponds to a just field J1, J2, J3. It will have some indices, but it's not very important here. And so it uses a triangle. And I can consider space that geometrically corresponds to having this joint union of triangles, like three. Just like this joint union of three separate chunks of space. Or I can consider something like composite states. This and this, for example. So this also will correspond to state. And the contraction will be done in the extra indices. So that these objects should correspond to something like J1, J2, J3, K1, K2, K3. Oh, I write this way before the Y. And then we have another one, J3, J4, J5, K3, K4, K5, and we sum over K3. We just contract. So we glue. And of course, the edge length has to be the same. It's the same edge. So we can consider objects like this or just these joint ones.
I can just
put that 5, J1, J2, J3
as a number.
Sorry? 5, J1, J2, J3 as a number. Well, in the same sense as this is a number for a given tree geometry. For a given assignment of J1, J2, J3, K1, K2, K3, that is a number.
So what is 5, J1, J2, J3, K1, K2?
Well, it's the same function for a different choice of point. So maybe I should write it better like this. So this is a function of J1, J2, J3, and of the indices, right? And then I have another same function, but computed in a different point, J3, J4, J5.
But what he's saying is that in the second case, the function takes its value in a
I can consider, that's why I called it a composite state. It's a bit like having two particles. The corresponding Hilbert space is actually a tensor product. So when I start composing states like this, I change the Hilbert space in which my function lives. My element lives. So but here, just to show you, in which sense going local increases the flexibility of the formulas. Okay.
Where is the case?
Sorry?
Where is the case? You have K1,
K2, K3.
Imagine the K. In the momentum J, then you have an M from J to J.
Yes, so you consider another object.
Yeah, it's a different object. Sure. Yeah. I'm just saying that the states I can put on the boundary of which I can compute the final diagram can be of different types, can correspond to objects of this type, or correspond to the individual ones, fine. Just something I can put on the boundary. And okay, I can tell you later after I show you the final construction, what kind of observables you put, and those generate different types of boundaries, boundary data. Okay. Maybe there is another way in which I can tell all this. Okay, so this is so much for the initial setting. then I can just tell you what the possible action is and how the Feynman diagrams are constructed out of it, and in which sense they reproduce space-time, simply visual space-time. So consider the factors, right? So the kinetic term should be quadratic, right? So G1, G2, G3. And then phi. Let's put a generic kinetic term in the middle, and then phi, G1, delta, delta, G3. In the kinetic term, it should be a function that tells me how these arguments are related to this. In the ordinary field theory case, this was just phi x, phi y, delta x. Well, it was actually the kinetic operator, g squared plus x squared, acting here. And then, sorry, it was actually its kinetic operator, x minus y, y, integrated over x and y. Okay? Are you here?
Yeah.
Is this fine? Or are you two already on?
I missed the start.
Okay, so let me just rewrite it. So the kinetic term in the ordinary field theory was phi of x, it was d squared plus m squared phi x, and there was an integral over dx, right? And I can write this if I want to make explicit the structure of the kinetic term. This is p x minus y phi y, and integrate over both y and x. It's the same object. So I'm just identifying what is the kinetic operator that I have to invert to get the propagator and to construct the final articles. Okay. So in general here, we will have two fields, each function of three variables, three group variables in SU2 in our case. Like here, we have phi of x and phi of y. And there would be some kinetic operator there that could be a function of g1, g2, g3, g1 tilde, g2 tilde, g3 tilde. Okay. Just as here, the choice of the kinetic term is part of my definition of the action, so my definition of the theory, scale of field theory. Here, the specific choice I make for the kinetic term is part of the definition of my action and my theory for the field over the group. Okay. And then, in general, I will have. So this is the kinetic term, and then I will have, and there will be integrals from. Integrals over the group, so SC2 of dg1, blah blah, blah blah, dg3 tilde. Okay, I'm integrating over all the variables that I have there. Just again, just as in the ordinary field theory. Well, I'm considering the specific example of the Kunzun-Reggie model. Okay. Well, not yet, because I haven't told you what the kinetic term is. So now I've just restricted everything to three dimensions so that you can visualize the geometry and make contact with what I told you earlier about the geometry of the three-dimensional manifold system for all. Good, so we have a kinetic term, and then there will be an interaction term, so we expect a coupling constant. Now, how to choose the interaction term? Well, you can do all sorts of strange stuff, but the models that are studied present, basically, make you obtain what you want, which is you want that Feynman diagrams of this Grufeld theory have the interpretation of this initial three-dimensional manifold in this three-dimensional example. So three-dimensional manifolds are given, as I told you, by gluing tetrahedron. So the idea, and while each field corresponds to a triangle here, as we said. So the idea is that a tetrahedron should correspond to an interaction vertex of my Feynman diagrams in such a way that it will be possible, after I do the Feynman's function, to reinterpret, for example, something very simple like this as a tetrahedron with four triangles on the boundary. This is a possible minimal three-dimensional manifold, simplicial manifold, just one tetrahedron. Right? So there will be a field here, there will be a field here, another field here, another field here. So two particles here going into two more particles. Geometrically, it's like a tetrahedron. Two triangles going into other two triangles. And this simple final graph is the simplest example of a three-dimensional manifold you will construct out of these building blocks. And then you want to be able to construct a more complicated examples. Two tetrahedra glued together along a common triangle, and so on. So the basic building block of my interaction is going to be four valent vertex, because it has to represent a tetrahedron. Right? So let's write structure. So all the variables that I'm going to write down are going to be integrated. So please allow me not to write all the integrals over the group for each variable that appears. Okay? So there will be, so it should be a four valent interaction. So G1, G2, G3. And then I have, and this is one triangle. 1, 2, 3. Then there should be another one. And this other one has to be glued along one of the arguments, because the next triangle is glued to the first one along one of the edges. Okay? So I can write G3 tilde, G4, G5, but then I should have delta G3 tilde. Okay? And then I have another 5, and it's going to be G5 tilde, G2. Tilde G6. But now G5 has to be identified, G5 tilde has to be identified with G5 here, because again, I have to glue another triangle to the others. So there will be delta G5 tilde, but also the third triangle is glued to both the previous two triangles. So there will be another delta, G2 tilde. And then there will be a fourth field, G6 tilde, G1 tilde, G4 tilde, with a bunch of delta function again. Okay, you're right with this. So I'm just representing the interaction of four triangles forming a tetrahedron. That's the basic interaction vertex that is going to represent my building block for space-time in the Feynman function. Okay. So I've erased it, but you see that in this case, the interaction operator that I'm going to use in order to construct my Feynman amplitudes here, again, instead of being just lambda, it's going to be lambda times a product of delta functions that tells me how the different arguments are glued together. Okay, you see this? And then what about the kinetic term? Well, what I want to do is to, as I said, obtain a simplicial complex as a Feynman diagram. So what the propagation should amount to is gluing two tetrahedra along a common triangle. So the basic propagation will be, I have one vertex of interaction with one tetrahedra, another vertex of interaction that is another tetrahedra, and the propagation from one to the other is this gluing. So two triangles in one and the other are identified. I wish I could do it. Sorry, I leave for 2 minutes. I'm back in the dessert. Okay. So, are you? Is this clear? So I write you explicitly the kinetic term.
So actually, the triangle between two tetrahedra appears to be propagating or something.
Mm-hmm. So the basic propagation should amount to, again, a bunch of delta function tilde g two tilde delta g two tilde. It tells me that if I take one triangle in one tetrahedron, so coming from one interaction, and the same triangle coming from another tetrahedron, which is another vertex of interaction, they're actually the same. So I identify them. And so I obtain this picture, which graphically, Feynman diagram, is something like this. Okay. Okay, so I have my kinetic term and I have my vertex term, and they're both given by a bunch of delta functions. Okay.
So, one question, I mean, what's the correspondence if you have like a loop diagram?
A loop. We need that you take a tetrahedron, you glue it to another tetrahedron, and it comes back. Mm-hmm. Look.
Yeah, no, that's because I don't need to do
that. Now, a better picture here that helps to visualize immediately that here we're doing something that is not ordinary in field theory. Although, well, if you got this picture, it should look kind of intuitive from the point of view of geometry, so the simplicial geometry, is to actually represent each line of propagation, not with a line, but with three lines, one for each argument. Okay? So a line of propagation is actually something like this. Right? You could do the same in ordinary field theory, so this is not the strange part. The strange part is about the right. So let's write down a vertex. A vertex has four fields. Each has three arguments. So what the vertex operator here tells me, so the vertex term in the action tells me, is that these is glued here to a delta function. So this line from one of the fields is actually the same as the line coming from one of the other fields. And again, this one triangle being glued along an edge with another triangle. This is glued here, this is glued here, this is glued here, this is glued here, and this is glued here. If it doesn't look strange to you, it's because you don't have in mind the same picture written for an ordinary scale of field theory in three dimensions. That would go something like this. I can also take three lines for each propagation, because I have 5 over R3, so it's 5, 3 coordinates. Okay? I just decide to write it x1, x2, x3, just as I did it there. But then the interaction is local. It means that they all interact in the same point for every atom. That means that this interacts here, this here, this here, and say is here. And the same is for the other one. And the same is for the other. So I have interaction, interaction, interaction. There's no strange combinatorial structure. It's like the same 4 valent vertex, like this, 3 times. But I don't have to take into account any strange combinatorials of the arguments. They all interact in the same point. Well, this one is genuinely non-local. It means that of the 3 arguments that I have, one interacts with only one of the others in a certain point, if you want. And the other interacts here. So a way to state this, I'm not sure it's so precise, but it's that the actual interaction is given by many bivalent interactions. Because the arguments are interacting, so identified, pairwise. So on the one hand, it's horrible because it is non-local and it has a non-trivial combinatorial structure. On the other hand, it may actually be easier than usual field theories, because there's no real higher order term if you just look at each argument, so each line of propagation. It's always bivalent. Okay, so it looks like a quadratic propagation more than a real interaction. Anyway, so this is not that crucial.
What is the argument for the propagator? It's so simple, just better for functions.
Here I'm just writing a specific model, which is the one that gives the Pongano Edger model. In principle, if the choice of interaction term and the choice of kinetic term defines your model, because it gives you the action that you're considering. I can consider other types of interaction and other types of kinetic terms. Now, if there, so let me see. The combinatorics has better be the same than here, even in a more complicated choice of interaction or kinetic terms, because I want to reconstruct as a finite diagram a simplicial complex where the combinatorics is fixed. I mean, is that triangles are actually sharing one argument, so one edge, not more than that. Even that can be relaxed. I can do more complicated things. But I may, first of all, relax the fact that they are just identified. Here, there's basically no real propagation. They're just the same. There's no propagating degree of freedom. I can change that. So keeping the combinatorics, I can change the functions that I have. Or I can do something even more and just change the combinatorics. I can imagine, for example, having my final graph corresponding not to a simplicial complex, but to an hypercubic lattice with a different type of structure. I should change the field, then I should change other things. But in principle, I can write it down.
I noticed something. When you redo the analogy between this concrete theory and usual free theory, you seem to say that the analogs of phi of j are the phi of x. But
well, it's more the other way around. The phi of x are more the analogs of phi of g. But
of g or j?
G, the group particles.
Because I would say that the analogs of the j are the g are the momentum, the momenta.
G are the momenta. Well, here I wouldn't really say that because I'm taking these as a group manifold, so that's my space time. So that's configuration space. Is the manifold on which the field is defined. So it's more analogous to X.
Because
in flat space,
that's the representations.
Are the edge lengths, okay. That's the geometric interpretation, I know. But as far as the formal structure of the field theory, this is better defined as better understood as configuration space. But I mean, it's just a name. I mean, that's the action that you do for your analysis and you go from one to the other. And then you have to interpret geometrically both these and the j's in the representation, and it better be consistent. But you can call it the way you prefer. I mean, the way is probably easier to call this, more natural to call this, is configuration.
If you have a delta, then if it's momentum, and the delta function is just when you have a line, you have conservation of the momentum.
But here it's not conservation, four balance conservation. Then it's just propagation from one line to another. So even if you were thinking that in those terms, I mean, the analogy would be a bit weak.
I'm so confused about loop diagrams. If you have just a single loop going off a propagator, just a second.
You take a vertex like this, glue that to another vertex there.
Because, I mean, that would be like gluing two faces together.
Yeah. In fact, each loop, if you consider just one of these lines going around, these identify, I was going to say it in a second.
If I had like the loop with the, well, propagator with the loop.
But it's not that, wait. What do you mean with the propagator loop? Oh, you mean a diagram like this?
Yeah.
Well, here you should, there's just one interaction.
Yeah.
And then there will be something like this.
Yeah, okay, but then what does it geometrically?
Well, just that you're identifying, so there's just one interaction, so there's just one tetrahedron,
yeah,
and you're identifying one triangle to the opposite one, to another one. It's a non trivial topology.
Okay.
You just identifying two faces.
Okay.
Yeah, you obtain in the final expansion, I'm going to highlight in a second, all this type of feature, you obtain all sorts of simplicial complexes. And by the way, in the general case, they're not even manifolds. They have singularities and stuff.
Does the analogy carry over that you can interpret such a thing as a soft energy?
Nobody
knows.
That diagram introduced was a soft energy. Nobody knows. It would be hard to define what the energy for that is. It's not local, and there's no isometry in space-time.
Probably what appear as, you say, correction of the problem.
You can definitely study the renormalization of this stuff and try to absorb loop diagrams into the propagator or the interactor. Yeah. It's not been done. So I don't know what the answer would be, but I don't see why you couldn't do it. It's just the physical interpretation energy that would be there.
If you call the analogy with ordinary Feynman diagrams, usually you choose the direction of time. And in that particular time, the number of external legs corresponds to the number of particles. And so when you have a diagram like this with the cross four things, if you have time wave one way, there are two particles coming in interacting, and then two particles coming out. So in your analogous situation where you also have four external legs, you can still view it as the interaction of two symplices coming in well there, of course.
You can think of it as a triangle representing the particle, right, interacting with another one to form two more. Or you can think of it as three triangles interacting to form one.
And so in your diagram, the original two triangles have one face or one edge in common. Mm-hmm. And then when they come out, is it that the interaction has caused a separate edge to be in common? And that's the interaction is just the curvature.
The old picture, I mean, here I want to motivate and give you a physical picture behind all the formula of the particles and represented by triangles and so on. But I mean, the old Fock structure, for example, the Fock space of these triangles, so these field operators, has not been done. So there are many things that need to be done to substantiate the picture.
Right.
I mean, at least this, as a picture at the moment, is consistent, but the details need to be worked out. What is known about group field theories at present, and that's the only thing I want to show now here, apart from the idea in the general picture, is the Feynman expansion. So what I'm going to show, I'll skip a few details, but what I'm going to tell you is that the Feynman expansion of this particular field theory gives the Ponzano-Reggio model for each Feynman diagram. So the idea is the following. By construction, if you want, a Feynman diagram of this field theory can be put in one-to-one correspondence with a triangulation of three-dimensional of a three-dimensional space. Okay, so with a three-dimensional simplicial complex. by construction, because this is exactly how I define the action. I define it in such a way that the interaction has the same combinatorics as a tetrahedron, that the kinetic term has the same combinatorics as the gluing of two tetrahedra along the common triangle. So when I start building up my Feynman diagram, I glue these interaction vertices together, I connect them with lines of propagation and so on. The whole thing is going to be put in one-to-one correspondence with a simplicial complex, three-dimensional simplicial complex. So this is okay, you say, well, good, but I mean, you define it so that it does that, so it's not very clever. The interesting thing is that this choice of functions, so not only the combinatorics, but this particular choice of function, which is, by the way, the simplest one you can think of, in my opinion, gives you as a Feynman amplitude, so the corresponding object to this one, Feynman amplitude for each graph, the Bunzano-Regge spin form model defined on the triangulation corresponding to that graph. We've seen that in the Bunzano-Regge model, you choose the triangulation, you take BF theory, you discretize it, you do integrals, you rearrange the terms, and you get a spin form model defined on that triangulation. That spin form model for a given triangulation is what you obtain as a Feynman amplitude from this field theory. Okay.
It defines the edge length of that triangle.
Yes, so?
So it actually corresponds to the dual triangle version of that
triangle. What you're saying is that if I take the dual phase to an edge, the representation is associated to the dual phase. But this is exactly the same as thinking of it associated to the edge. They are in one-to-one correspondence. For each dual phase, and you spin from model as a representation for each dual phase, there is an edge. In fact, if you remember, I've written the Bunzano-Regge model, the coefficient function, both in terms of the triangulation, edges, and tetrahedra, or in terms of dual phases and vertices. The combinatorics is the same. So the J is associated to each edge, as is consistent with this picture.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, for example, the interaction on the tetrahedron, right? You have an interaction, and then that's actually correspond to the vertex inside the tetrahedron, which is the invariant tensor, right?
No, the vertex inside the tetrahedron corresponds to the thick J symbol. You remember that for each triangle there was an invariant tensor? There was the 3J symbol, just 3J's for the three edges of the triangle. And then all together, the four of them for each tetrahedron, will define a number, which is the amplitude for that tetrahedron. And in fact, you can, I'll tell you what, now one way in which you can obtain that. That would be associated to each vertex of interaction, the J symbol.
Yeah, that's what okay. I understand.
Oh, good, let me try. What did you want to say? Now that I agree that it's correct, I think first to see the purpose, but okay. It's good that we agree. Okay, so let's see one way in which we can do it. Okay. I'm not going to show you all the details of the calculation, but it is rather straightforward. So you remember that we've said that each field has to be invariant under the simultaneous action on the three arguments of our NC2 tuple. So invariant under the group action. Okay, that was one of the that was the constraint defining a triangle and not just a bunch of free edges. Okay. So I can actually, the thing is defined this way, and that here there is an internal DG. So I impose that whatever I group element and multiply, the thing is invariant. Okay. And the same is for each of the fields with different group elements, all integrated. Okay.
What do you need to do? So that the intrinsic definition of the field? Why do you need to integrate all of the
fields? Okay, because what I actually do, instead of the.
It's intrinsic in the.
By doing it that way, I don't do it intrinsically. So I don't impose it intrinsically, I don't leave it implicit. But what I do is take a generic field that is not invariant and impose this integral.
Yeah.
The imposition of this integral makes it invariant.
Yeah.
Is it clear why it does? Because if now, on this newly defined field with the integral, I take a multiplication by g, I can basically absorb it in the integral by changing the measure. That's the higher measure on the group, and so it doesn't change anything. So it gives me back exactly the same object I started with. Okay. So the same integration I perform on all the four fields to impose the constraint that they are there on the group. And then another way to do it is, instead of considering the group element there, I can consider it here. So there is G, there is G, there was another G here. So you say, I can just say here, instead of G3, G, I write only G3 and put the G here. It's the same, just a change of value. You see that? Instead of just working with G3, it's like working with G3, G. Okay? And here as well, there was a G tilde that I was supposed to include under integration to impose gauge invariance of this other field. And instead of writing it here, I can impose it here, g tilde, and then there was a g5 there, and then there was the others. Okay, so I can change variables and have this extra group elements appearing in the delta function. So I'm basically putting this group elements, instead of in the definition of the field, in the definition of the kinetic operator. But I can do it here, and I can do it in the interaction operator.
So then we need to include some factor which corresponds to the volume of the
normalized one.
Okay.
I mean, it's a compact group, so it's just the volume of the three sphere.
Yeah.
I normalize everything to one, and I don't care. Normalize the measure, I mean the R measure, so that the integral gives me one.
Yeah.
The non-compact Lorentz case is more complicated, but you can do that thing as well. Okay? You can do something like that as well. Okay, so let me just write this basically. The can I do it? Let me do it here. I don't want to do it, because otherwise I demand less things. So instead of showing you the calculation, it's immediate to see the following. The vertex operator is just a product of delta functions with this structure. G whatever, prime, and then there are deltas, G6, and then it will be G double tilde, G6 tilde, G double prime over M. Okay? So I just extract from here the vertex. And it's a bunch of delta functions. You look completely lost. I'm just writing, extracting the vertex that I have to use for constructing Feynman amplitudes from here. And just write it here more or less explicitly. And there will be integrals over these additional group elements here. Okay. Not integrals over these variables at first, when I just identify the interaction term. And then I have a kinetic term, which also has 10 more minutes, which also has the structure of a bunch of delta functions. Here it's easier to see because the group elements that I have to include are the same in all the deltas.
Can you skip the GT? It's redundant, right?
That's redundant, yeah. But okay, if I just follow the procedure and impose the constraint on each field, I get two of them. Then I can redefine my variables and one is completely useless. But, yeah, there is a bit of redundancy in this description. And here there is a product over dg, and in principle there is this g tilde that I can, if I want, I can drop. Okay, so I have my kinetic term, I have my vertex term, and I know from Feynmanology, so from just the theory of Feynman diagrams, that the amplitude is constructed, as in this simple example, by associating this object to each vertex of interaction, from my Feynman diagram. This kinetic term, well, the inverse of this, but in this case the inverse is going, again, to be given by a product of delta functions. So the inverse is itself. So the propagator is just the same as the kinetic term. So I have to associate this to each line of propagation, or better, to each set of three lines of propagation. And this object to each vertex. For each vertex of interaction, I write this stuff. For each line of propagation, I write this stuff. And then I do the integrals over the common variables, so that basically I glue this with this, this with this, this with this, to form the whole mushroom, excluding the boundaries. On the boundary, I will have my variables there.
Did you say that the inverse of that kinetic operator is itself?
I did.
Sorry.
Yeah, very fine. I'm not going to do it in 2 minutes.
Okay.
It's not that hard. It's a function inverse, so it should give you a delta function of the arguments, of the three arguments. Anyway, so what happens is that I take this interaction term, I take this kinetic term, I use them as building blocks for my Feynman amplitude, so for constructing the analog of this object. And what happens is that for a given triangulation, which is basically the same as saying for a given Feynman graph, this object is going to be given by a product over all the lines of propagation of an integral over the group. And then I would have product over all the dual phases. Basically, the dual phases meaning all loops that I identify following one of these lines going around my Feynman diagram, and for a closed manifold. So for a closed graph, it should come back to the original point, or possibly to another point, but at the end it will still identify two cells. You see that? Are you lying? Because the first time I was told, I didn't believe it. If you consider a closed graph, there's no boundary in which the lines can end, right? So each of these lines of propagation should at some point form a loop. Okay, if you just follow it from vertex to vertex. It doesn't necessarily have to be back here. It can be back here and then you keep going and at the end it goes back there. That's just a very strange topology, but it can do that. But at the end it will identify two cells. So for each of these two cells that I write f star, the object will just be a delta function over a product of group elements, each associated with each line of propagation, for all the lines of propagation that bound the two cells. So I put a star here, I put a star here, I put a star here, and this is exactly the Gonzalo Reggio model we have seen last time. Except that this is written in configuration space, so in terms of group elements, before I do any harmonic analysis. So before I expand my representations. Now, of course, I know that each Feynman diagram, each Feynman amplitude can be written in configuration space or in momentum space. I just do the Fourier analysis. So I can do the Fourier analysis here, and I will obtain the Gonzalo-Reggio model as a spin form model, as we've written it the last time. Well, and it, as it was written on the blackboard some time ago. Alternatively, I know also from field theory that I can do the harmonic analysis, so the Fourier expansion, at level of the action directly. So I can just write my interaction term and my kinetic term in momentum space. So in terms of representations, these are, again, these are functions on the group. So I can do harmonic analysis of them, okay? And what they will tell me, instead for the kinetic term, it's easy to see, instead of just deltas over group elements, I would get deltas over representations, J1 tilde. One corresponding to expanding respect to this variable, and the other corresponding to expanding respect to this variable. But again, it will just be gluing edges together for different triangles. And for this, but on top of this, because of the combinatorics, the object that will appear here is, surprisingly enough, the sig j symbol. That will end up being associated to each vertex of interaction. And the vertex of interaction is the vertex of the dual complex, the triangulation that corresponds to the Feynman diagram. So again, it's exactly the Gonzalo-Reggio model. So either I expand here in momentum representation, or I expand at the level of the action, so if you want, at the level of the separate interaction kinetic operators. Whatever I do, I'm going to get as a Feynman amplitude for my graph. So for my Feynman graph, equivalent for my triangulation, three-dimensional triangulation, the Gonzalo-Reggio model. Okay. So let me just write down a final formula, which is the end result of the group field theory. The group field theory expansion in Feynman data. So what I get is that, in principle, I would like to define my theory in non-perturbative. So I have a functional integral of E minus my action for the field, where the action is this one. Okay? But as in ordinary field theory, what I can do until I learn how to do this non-perturbatively, until I learn how to compute the Feynman path integral for the field non-perturbatively, is to expand in Feynman diagrams that is equivalent, in this case, as summing over triangulations, one for each Feynman diagram, with the weight for each triangulation being basically the power of the coupling constant corresponding to the number of vertices of that triangulation. This. Okay. Then there will be some symmetry factor here. Basically, it's to avoid counting many times the same triangulation only because I built it up in a different way. At the end, the same triangulation as another one. So there is a symmetry factor correction there. And then the Feynman amplitude is going to be my spin form model my spinform model for the choice of triangulation, and in turn the spinform model is going to be given by a sum for the representations associated with the appropriate places of the triangulation, orange one on the final graph, and then there will be a product of amplitude for each dual phase. Vertices with a certain amplitude, and they're all functions of the representations relevant to this, to that vertex, to the to that edge, and well, there will be only one for each dual face. Okay, the specific case I consider here is the one in which this object is the Fonzano region model. But this structure is completely general. At the end, the final expansion of my group field theory will give me a sum over triangulations, with each triangulation weighted by a spinform model defined on that triangulation. Now, is this structure clear? Because there are a few comments that should raise the interest, but if you don't understand the point, you're not going to be more interested about it after I give you my comments. So what's the doubt, if you have any?
Well, now that you're doing perturbation theory on a non-perturbative quantum gravity, the question is, once you write this down, is it renormalizable? And if it isn't, we're right back to where we started.
Ah, so the point is clear.
Okay.
So it is clear what the structure of the perturbative function is.
Yeah.
Ah, that was the thing that should be clear before I start commenting on what is known, what is not known, or what is the good point, what is the bad one. So doubts about the point I made.
Do we doubt technically or doubt about how you get the result of the theory?
No, because otherwise I should ask questions instead of give answers.
Because
about reality, then I should actually ask questions instead of trying to give answers. But there are many things that I'm not understanding. Do you understand? What I mean is simply the following. Do you understand in which sense, well, how, forgetting about the little details, from this action, so from an action for a field theory defined over a group manifold with certain properties and a certain choice of interaction and kinetic term, I get a sum over spinform models for all possible triangulations.
Yes.
Do you see this? Then I'm happy. Now you can start with all the questions about meaning and future and outlook. That was the other thing I wanted to talk about.
So, from the regular sort of film action, is there a way to connect somewhere before we
Yeah, one way to connect it is to do the harmonic analysis, so the expansion representations, already here at the level of the action. Because when you're expanding representations, this, which is basically being read the bunch of deltas that appear in this interaction term, when you expand that in representation, as I said here, you get a J symbol already there. So it will appear, the J symbol will appear here before you do anything else. So you will already see at the level of the action, of the field theory, the building blocks for the Fonzano region spinform model. Then, of course, you don't see the translation corresponding to the Fonzano region, but you see just the basic ingredients.
I mean, usually when you have other quantum theories, usually you start with a classical field theory, which has a classical analogy. I mean, when you start with a theory like this, that doesn't have anything like a classical analogy. So how can you be sure that this is can be the right set to do.
So the short answer is indeed we are not sure that is the right thing to do. The additional thing to say is that the classical theory corresponding to Gouffre theories is not known. And this thing started seriously like 5 years ago.
It was Gouffre reinvented for the 3D Poisson regime model.
Mm-hmm. But that was earlier. But there was no systematic study of Gouffre theories or no construction of other models and so on. There was just one specific model that was constructed by Bulatov in 92 for Poisson regime, or better, for Turek 0, which is the quantum default version of the regime. And actually, this, strictly speaking, is a second step, because the first step was to generalize matrix models, which are basically this structure, except that instead of fields over a group matrix, we just have matrices, to tensor models, which are three images instead of two. You see that in your representation space, when you expand, this is going to have three images. This is a tensor model, except that the sum over all the possible dimensions for the images. But that was the first thing that was tried by Ambjorn and collaborators, again, in the beginning of the 90s. But then there was no real systematic study of Gouffre theories. Then in 99, when it was seen, it was shown that you could do it also in four dimensions. And so it was really a general structure. And again, it would give you the spin form model that has been studied, that was studied in that period by the Barre-Crane model. Then more interest arise in about this, because it seemed, and then it was also proven by Michael Rosenberger and Rovelli, Carlo, that for every spin form model, some cavity should be local and blah blah blah, for every spin form model, there is a corresponding group field theory that for which the spin form model in which the spin form model arises in the final expansion. And the other way around. For every Gouffre theory you can write down, you can isolate an interaction term and a vertex term, and that will give rise to a spin form model. So, I mean, the more study started to be done only recently. So, yes?
In regular case theories, when we construct the functions and then we draw the final diagrams, usually we have some disconnected diagrams, and then we take the log of the final function.
You can do it here.
But here, it seems that we don't have disconnected ones. So it's here all about the triangulation, and if the manifold is connected, the triangulation should be.
No, but here you start viewing, basically, again, the reason why you can have disconnected diagrams is that once you have told me how many vertices you have, I'm free to connect them in all sorts of ways. And that's the same here. The triangulations I'm summing over here are all sorts of stuff. So for example, they correspond to some manifold and another one, because I've taken a tetrahedra here, and then another two here, but I've glued these only among themselves, and the others here instead form a larger structure. And I didn't connect this to here. I can do all the theoretic analysis. I mean, also in this case.
Yeah, there's an expected generating function.
Yeah, you can work with generating functions and all the rest. So okay, now since we have minus 5 minutes, I want to tell you just a few things. So I'll tell you why I decided to devote this lecture to Gouffre theory and not to some other spin form models. And so what is interesting here, in my opinion? So one thing is already evident from what you said, basically, is the fact that it's a field theory. That means that at least at the formal level, you have all the technology that has been developed for quantum field theories, at least most of it, that it doesn't strictly depend on locality. So the generating functional techniques, perturbative expansion, non-perturbative techniques in terms of final diagram, in terms of path integrals, well, all sorts of technology developed for field theory that can be applied here. And the question is not so much to write it down, to apply it rather than the formula, but okay, mathematically makes sense of the various formulae and so on, especially in the non-compact case. But physically, it's to interpret quantum geometrically the objects that you get by manipulating in field theoretic language. Because, okay, we found that the quantum gravity interpretation of the partition function, because it's a kind of a partinkle for gravity for a given triangulation. We've seen that the final graph can be interpreted geometrically as a simplicial complex to which you assign geometric data. So we know part of the story. But then when you start computing, I don't know, randomization for this field theory, you start summing Feynman diagrams and you reabsorb Feynman diagrams in evaluation in coupling constants, for example, what's that quantum geometrically? One interpretation would be coarse graining of my lattice gauge theory. So that gives me the continuum limit, which I'm able to do. So what is the interpretation of the Fock space? Can I really interpret it rigorously in a more meaningful way as creation and iteration of building blocks for my space? Well, you have to do the calculation, you have to see where, first of all, you can construct the Fock space, and then where the interpretation applies. And the same for everything. But I find it is a good thing that you have technology available and that you can start doing work with it. The other thing that I want to mention is the following. I told you that in the special case of the Pomzano-Regge model, so when this CJ symbol, 1, 2, 6, is the amplitude for each vertex, this object can be related to the cosine of the Regge action. Right? So, okay, it's the cosine and not the exponential, and there's a lot to say about this, but this is not crucial here. The important thing is that a sum over these geometric variables of an amplitude like this, it was for the old manifold, would basically mean that what we have here as an amplitude for each triangulation, so for each space-time, is something like a partinkle for gravity, right? Except you are in a discretized setting, like in Regge calculus. Do you remember I mentioned to you quantum Regge calculus? Because what you have here is some amplitude that can be associated to the exponential of the simplicial action, function of the j's, and you have a sum over all these j's. You see this? I try again. You see this?
Yes.
Okay, good. Come on. What I'm just saying is that once I understand that these representation labels have a geometric meaning, and I'm assigning an amplitude to my simplicial complex as a function of these representation labels, so as a function of this geometric data, what I have here is, like in Regge calculus, when I integrate over the edge lines, for example, and the amplitude is the exponential of the Regge action. So I have an amplitude from my geometry on a given triangulation, and I sum over the geometric degrees of freedom. But here, we have more, because we're also summing over triangulations. So I can say, well, forget about this sum. Consider just the subsector in which I have all the j's equal, for example. And I have a sum over all triangulations with an amplitude associated to each triangulation. And that is exactly, if you remember, again, the first lecture, the way quantum gravity is defined in the dynamical triangulations approach. Let's try something more. The amplitude is a spin flow model. That means on the boundary, my data are spin networks. So what I have here is a spin flow model as an evolution of spin networks. And that was another way that I introduced the idea of spin from models in the first lecture. So there is a relation, at least a theoretic link, with loop quantum gravity. Okay? You have spin networks on the boundary, and this object is supposed to compute differentiation amplitude between them. Even more, suppose that your Feynman graph, as usual in field theory, is oriented. So that that's exactly how it looks. Okay. Well, this object can be interpreted as a causal set. You've been told about causal sets by me, and I mentioned them also in the previous lecture. So you just have vertices like space-time events and causal relations connecting them.
I don't think we ever mentioned causal sets. That Rockdale circle was here for a year, and he gave some.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Whoever did, you have been told about causal sets. And by the way, I also cited them briefly in the first lecture. So what you have here, there is a caveat that is quite important. The spin, the Feynman diagrams that you get in this group field theory are not really causal set because you can orient them, but they can actually include things like closed time-like loops. In principle, you just keep just a loop of the Feynman diagram, so you just keep following it. And you can go back to the original point. So it's not causal set, it's a weaker structure.
That's not often.
Well, depends. For what?
Well, they're not real things. They can have closed time curves, so if they're virtual.
Okay.
They can.
Well, also, we can start a debate about that. But I mean, it's not just the causal set frame, it's a weaker type of structure. And so what the group field theory does is to assign an amplitude to each of these direct graphs, so a weaker structure than a causal set. But somehow it includes, at least some of the ingredients, also the causal set approach. So the only thing I'm saying here is that, from my personal perspective, one thing that is good about group field theories, among others, and if you talk with other people, they will tell you different things, good and bad, about group field theories, is that they seem to be a general framework in which you can see as subcases after lots of work, many other approaches to quantum gravity. So loop quantum gravity, because the canonical approach is, we know it, a special case of the covariant but integral approach. You can see the ingredients of quantum gravity calculus, you can see the ingredients of dynamical triangulations, and you can see the ingredients of causal sets.
How many ways can you quantize the same thing? So by working with...
There's better be more than one.
By working with loop quantum gravity, you're already quantizing the field. And then it seems that when you add further discretizations, you seem to be adding additional discrete structure.
But you have to distinguish between discretize and quantize. They are two completely different things.
Yes, when you quantize, hopefully the discrete structure merges out the eigenvalues.
No? I mean, well, you can think that, or you can...
It seems that... No. It seems that when you quantize a theory, that there's no reason to add additional discrete structure.
Additional discrete what?
Well, it seems that all these...
Here, I mean, if you just write the group field theory, the only discrete structure is the fact that you have a combinatorics to reproduce a simplicial complex. For example, if you use the Lorentz group, the representations are not going to be discrete in general. So that discrete structure would not be there. And it's a matter of debate whether you should try to get a discrete structure in that sense or in the sense of a discrete space-time.
Actually, when you wrote down the S2 and J times J plus 1, I was actually assuming that J were integers.
In that case, for SC2, yes, they are half integers. But I'm saying that these formulas can be written down and studied in the Lorentz case for SO21 or SO31 or whatever non-compact group you want to consider. And then the expansion representations is going to give you also continuous representations in general. So that type of discrete structure is not going to be there, but it's not straightforward.
So
So, and then it's really a matter of opinion whether you feel that you have to go in one direction or another. Of course, I mean, here, until you get at least one theory that works, we can start debating about what the right ingredients are. I'm just telling you that what I like here, among other things, is the fact that I see the ingredients of different approaches, all playing a role.
You just need to formulate it in 11 dimensions and
and then it's done. Now, can I tell you something different? Okay, about, so the lecture is over. And